if we know that these networks are used in very purposeful ways, how do we sort of exercise these networks in the classroom?
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin. Today, we have a double espresso with Dr. Anna Abraham, who is the E. Paul Torrance Professor and Director of the Torrance Center for Creativity and Talent Development at UGA's Mary Frances Early College of Education. Her educational and professional training has been within the discipline of psychology and neuroscience, and she has worked across a diverse range of academic institutions and departments all over the world, all of which have informed her multidisciplinary focus. She investigates the psychological and neurophysiological mechanisms underlying creativity and other aspects of the human imagination. Her wide-ranging contributions to the field of creativity include theoretical, methodological, and empirical advances in the context of basic and applied research. She has penned numerous publications, including the so-authored The Neuroscience of Creativity and the multidisciplinary edited volume, The Cambridge Handbook of the Imagination. She is the founding editor of the Cambridge Element Series in Creativity and Imagination, which we'll be talking about on the second episode of this espresso. So, Anna, we are so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So, let's start with some very basic things that our audience will really be able to understand, and then let's build from there because we have a lot of questions for you. So, let's talk about neuroscience. Now, you've written a paper on the creative mind, and you've written a paper on the imaginative mind, and you've also written a paper on the wandering mind. So, can you explain the difference between a creative mind and an imaginative mind, and what are the similarities and what are the differences?
If we think about how creativity and imagination relate to each other, you'd say, in order to be creative, you have to use your imagination. But if you're using your imagination, you're not always being creative. Yeah, you can use your imagination in ways that are very predictable. You know, you can imagine things that have transpired. You can imagine things that are true. You can imagine the past that has taken place and so on. So the imagination is not only used for the purpose of coming up with, you know, new ideas, new ways of expressing yourself and so on. So that would be the difference between the two, in that the creative mind is one way in which to be imaginative.
So Anna, from this research, what has surprised you the most? Or perhaps what have you discovered that you find most curious when it comes to creativity, and maybe particularly how it might apply to cultivating and facilitating creativity in others?
Well, a lot has surprised me, and I find a lot fascinates me about it. I think what's interesting when you take a neuroscientific approach is understanding how the mind is kind of made for creativity. So one of the most fascinating things is that the flexibility with which brain networks kind of are in place, that there's no one way to be creative. Like there's not a simple stream of how brain processes kick into action in order to be creative. That's, I think, kind of powerful. The second really powerful thing I find is that a lot of neuropsychological work with, you know, patients who have different types of brain injury, I've found that kind of stuff a lot more interesting in terms of telling us what parts of the brain are important for what aspects of creativity, right? And what I've come to understand now is that when you look at different patient groups or different types of injuries and so on, the thing that really stands out is kind of the disease-resistant capacity of the brain to be creative. You know, it's very, if you think about it, sort of like little lesions here and there would cut out huge functions. But in almost all cases, barring like super chronic types of stages of illness, people manage to continue to be creative. You know, even people who've, it seems to be there's something about our need to be creative that is really sort of, that you see in neuropsychological studies at all. So that was perhaps the most surprising thing to me, that it's really hard not to be creative, even in cases of sort of quite stark brain injury. So that has given me a lot of food for thought of about, you know, what are the things that we don't consider when we try to examine creative thinking in the lab, right? We think of it as perhaps quite cognitive or essentially problem-solving oriented. We look at the things that seem obvious, but there's a lot behind the scenes that are not as obvious but seem to be super important. Things like motivation and drive and just the need for expression that seems to be sort of the driving force. And I find all of that kind of fascinating.
So can you tell us more about the neurophysiological mechanisms underlying creativity?
Well, there's no one mechanism. That's the way to think about it. We're still in the very sort of, I would say it's the infancy stage still at trying to understand things. Depending on what you're looking at, you'll find different answers. So my own work has kind of showed that the really important network to consider here is the semantic cognition network. Yeah. In terms of how it interacts with other brain networks to bring about novelty. The thing about the way, if you think about the imaginative mind and the way that I've conceived of it in terms of its structure, creativity is one aspect of imagination, the part of the imagination in which you're trying to engage the imagination in a way that's calls for novel combinatorial kinds of thinking. And when you're doing that, it seems that one network on its own is not enough. It takes the confluence of many brain networks working together in a sort of extremely fluid manner. You know, that's one thing that is absolutely clear. You're obviously using your conceptual networks, which are your semantic networks. And in order to get to a very novel space, you have to override the path of least resistance. And that calls for the added engagement of other brain networks, such as the executive function network and so on. So a lot of work across labs kind of focuses now on how networks interact with each other, and people might focus on different types of networks. So some people will focus on the default mode network and the executive function network. My own work as well has shown that, well, the mechanisms will differ depending on whether you're kind of looking at creativity in general, how all of us are creative, compared to looking at individual differences in creativity. So when you're looking at people who have, at least on the kinds of measures we use, are highly creative versus not as creative, you see that the highly creative groups use their brains slightly differently. That speaks to differences in knowledge access and knowledge organization, the salience coding of the engagement in the task, and so on. So that's why I said the answer is complicated depending on what our level of analysis is.
So Anna, could you help us kind of like translate this to a classroom environment? You know, when you're talking, you're speaking very much about, you know, the individual, the person aspect of the kind of creativity research. But you've written a lot about context and our relationship with context. And so I'm curious about how these networks kind of interact with each other within a classroom environment. Could you talk and expand a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in terms of how do we apply this sort of knowledge? So if you think, what do you need in order to generate a creative response or to elicit a creative response? Most of it is about the source material, which is your knowledge. In a classroom, it would be about, well, what are you asking them to do there that's calling them to be creative? If you can find ways in which to expand on whatever conceptual source they are looking at, they're much more likely to lead to novel solutions. So if you look at the kind of games people can play in classes to get their kids to like think more deeply or think more laterally about things, part of doing that is to say, well, you know, let's say, what do you see at the tip of this pencil? Let's say, you say, what do you see there? And you're like, it's a pencil. But what else could it be if you look at it this way? I'm essentially holding a pencil with the point of the pencil facing the camera. And you can ask them, well, it's a pencil. I say, well, what else could it be? What else could it be? Take different perspectives. And what you're trying to do then is to say, well, is it a point? Is it a hole? Is it a tunnel? Is it an abyss? Like if you get them to use their networks in a way that facilitates a sort of lateral flow, that leads to more interesting combinations coming up, you know? That's the kind of way in which you think, okay, I know it has to do with this great, flexible, fluid interaction between knowledge access and the way my knowledge is organized. And everyone in the classroom has a different level of, you know, that's going to vary between us. But what one person says will elicit a lot of a chain of associations, the other person, and so on and so forth. You know, I might see this as a tunnel and the other person's like, oh, I didn't see that that way. That's interesting. And that immediately leads to a whole sort of chain reaction of sort of associative flow in their own minds. And so that would be one way, for instance, to think, okay, if we know that these networks are used in very purposeful ways, how do we sort of exercise these networks in the classroom? And we could do that with all sorts of open-ended games, all sorts of just, it doesn't have to be like a game. It can just be sort of hypothetically reasoning, what if kind of, you know, scenarios to think about. When you're using that in a way to sort of exercise those muscles, so to speak, they're just much more likely to look at the world that way. And that's essentially not screwing with their source material, but fundamentally changing the way they look at things. And if you do that in the classroom, they will apply it more widely. And if it's done in an interesting manner that's salient and interesting, that's going to stick with them. And then it will carry through, not just in the classroom, but outside.
You speak about this idea of organizing knowledge in the brain and these networks. And it just makes me feel that at least some of the traditional view of education, is it potentially problematic because we're packaging the information in the same way, perhaps trying to interfere with how it's organized in the brain. So therefore it can be retrieved in the same way in order to produce the same outcome because we want everyone to have that same outcome. So do you think that connection that I'm making with these kind of like traditional one-way transfer of information is problematic when it comes to some of the strategies that you're talking about, particularly around questions and getting students to kind of like build unique connections?
I'm not one for sort of unimodal forms of teaching or learning, which is the standard in most parts of the world as part of standard curriculum. And I think I'm not a fan of it because it's not based on really what we know about learning and memory and what counts as good consolidation, what you need to have good retrieval cues in order to essentially reach back to what you've learned. So how you encode information is really, really central to how well you'll be able to recall it later. And if it's only based on rote learning or memorizing in a very sort of factual manner, you will see a lot of individual differences in children there because some children are just very good at that and they have good learning strategies and other children are less likely to be able to learn as well in that, you know, I mean, I was never a very good rote learner, for instance, in school. I had to figure out some other ways to apply knowledge to my mind. And there were friends of mine who were excellent at that they just it didn't matter what they understood. They just could just learn facts. I know that there's a lot of interesting work by Mariel Hardiman, for instance, a couple of years ago, who ran perhaps the first randomized control trial of arts-based curriculum versus a standard curriculum in Baltimore. And she found that the same curriculum, if you teach it either, you know, classical approach, which is fact-based, linear, if you want, compared to arts-based, which is the same information, but taught in a multimodal manner with, you know, engaging your body, your musical sense, everything possible, that the outcome when they tested the kids after, I think it was a term, was that the performance did not improve in the kids who had high scholastic aptitude. But that's because they're good learners. They just know how, you can throw any kind of teacher or model at them. They just know how to learn. But arts-based curriculums were huge, hugely advantages in improving performance in average and low scholastic aptitude children. So, and that's because they retained knowledge, not just in one mode, but in multi. So if I was thinking about, okay, how do I remember the planets and what order they come in, you know, and I am just told it, I might memorize the correct order and I can do that kind of by rote. Or I don't remember it like that, but I do remember that me and my friend and a couple of us had to do this formation in class. And now I'm drawing on my visual sort of imagery there, that relying on that kinesthetically what it felt like, emotionally what it felt like, because it felt a bit silly and it was fun. So you have a lot more retrieval cues there. And that really helps people who've not that good at other forms of learning. And ultimately, it's about promoting learning. Like, why should we care what the path is? Because most of our models on why people should be taught in a very serial processing way are not based on anything solid from any kind of contemporary learning and memory sort of research. We know that information is learned. We know the conditions under which information is learned well and how we can prevent all kinds of forgetting. We know, you know, how you can teach information in a ways that will make it retain it, not just in the short term, but in the long term. So one of the modes is to consider how you encode information. And so parts of it is using your imagination, using, you know, all of your senses to try and code for information cannot but be a positive thing for learning, you know, because you have then not just one way of retrieving, but several, you know, four or five that you can draw back on, which is why a lot of like our mnemonics of when you're trying to just memorize information is based on song, you know, things like that, that it's just easy to recall. And that's, again, it's not just the information, it's the song, it's the tune. And that's much easier to like keep in mind than just a random selection of letters, for instance, could be another mnemonic.
As someone who used to be a professional dancer, I always said if I could dance my way through the curriculum, I would know so much more. And I think you just made such a great case for why it's important to teach creatively and not just through worksheets and rote learning. And I want to take a build on that, which is from a neuroscientist perspective, do you see that creativity can be taught?
So I know that I will never be a ballet dancer, right? So if I wanted to be a creative, that's some things are out of my reach, right? But if I wanted to be more creative in my life in general, in terms of how I can apply it, for sure that you can be. And it's, I think you don't even need neuroscientific evidence for that. It's very obvious from just behavioral studies that training effects are going to be there. How large they are, how long-term they are, things like that. I don't think there's enough work on that to understand, you know, those sorts of aspects of how long you need to train for. But certainly, you know, if you look at practitioners, creative arts, everything is about practice. Everything is about having a practice that is calls for dedication, that calls for space, that calls for time, that calls for engagement. And no artist will tell you that they were born with that ability and that they had and never evolved and never learned anything. I mean, they see it as an evolving practice. And that means that you can get better, you can evolve the way you think, it's not just about more and better at one thing, it's about looking at getting more and more skills in a different way, different perspectives. And so absolutely, you can be trained to be more creative, but we know from training studies that this has to be very intentional, has to be very specific. One has to be really mindful about what kind of thing you want to train as, or what is the thing that you want to be developing. And as opposed to sort of blindly saying, I just want to be more creative. This great meta-analysis done that showed that you can, you know, training works, but it works when one is really aware of what it is that you want to train.
So Anna, I'm going to take us in a different direction for a second. And I'm sorry to bring in a Hollywood film analogy, but I had a project a few years ago called Class of 2032. And basically it was an ideation workshop of about 20 to 30 minutes where I would kind of engage students and teachers in a discussion about what the future school experience might be like in the year 2032. And a really popular idea among both teachers and students was this kind of like matrix concept where we've got the ability to download a massive amounts of knowledge. Now, given your field, right, and given the ideas that were generated during the class of 2032, and I do know, of course, that there is work in this area, may we get to a point, you're talking about networks in the brain, where our brain does have the capacity to connect with an external network in order to kind of like facilitate and yield creative outcomes?
Well, we're kind of doing that already in many ways, because we are plugged into the whole world. We are, you know, offloading a lot of things that are now automated. You know, there's so much that is just automated now. I mean, we take it all for granted, but we have freed up a lot of our time and space to think more. We're connecting with people. The kind of things I see every day in terms of access to information, to beauty, to ugliness, it's just all there. So we are, as far as I can tell, we are already plugged into networks of social networks, technological networks, and so on. So the matrix idea is interesting of, you know, if I could, you know, I would love to learn jiu-jitsu, of course, in 5 seconds, that would be perfect. For me, that the interesting thing there is that if we have that capacity, And I'm not even someone to doubt that at some point we will be there. You know, I know that, you know, people like, I don't know, Elon Musk and stuff with Neuralink are trying to essentially get the capacity to automatize a lot of the ways. I mean, it's still early, such early stages, and probably won't see it in my lifetime for sure. But I think the interesting question there is, if we all have that capacity and we all know everything, what next, right? That's the more, what does that mean for creativity? And that if we are all having theoretically the same brain with the same information, that to me is a fascinating thing to think about. And in terms of, yeah, we're all sort of purposed to be this hyper-functioning people who can do everything. I wonder what that means for something like creativity. And I don't have the answer there, but I don't think it necessarily means something good.
Yeah, it's weird you say not something good. If anyone's a Trekkie here, you're immediately connecting to what you said to the Borg, right? And they just go around the galaxy destroying everything. So I could certainly concede that. And to pick up on something you said, though, you know, Michael Lynch has the book Internet of Us. And he does, you know, in a very kind of simple way, just highlight the fact that thanks to the World Wide Web, we don't actually have to rely on our brains to recall, for example, you know, the dates of the American Revolution or the American Civil War. We can now offload, right, that knowledge or that need to have that information simply to, you know, our phones now, that we can retrieve it. And therefore, does it provide us with more space to go and do other things with that knowledge?
Yeah, though that's the way I always see it. It's like, we're here, it's there, it's happening. Again, what's interesting is that you can always fact check each other, right? That's in real time. And that was never possible before. Like we are so efficient now. Like if I say, oh, who's the president of what? And we don't have to wait around for an answer or a guess. Each of us has the world at our fingertips, literally. So I always think about what is the downside or the upshot, if you want, of that. Has the space for, let's say, wonder? Has the space for, like, hypothetically going down, like, little blind alleys? Has all of that kind of evaporated when if we, you know, I mean, can you, I don't know, I still remember a time when, you know, you could talk all sorts of nonsense, complete falsehoods about things, and you know, someone would say, I'm absolutely certain that this person, I don't know, won this particular tennis game at that age. You're like, yeah, that's not, you know, you could have this whole hypothetical whatever about that and have great engaging discussions, and then you realize, oh, all of that is absolutely not true. That's interesting. But so I wonder about the fact that if we're all so right, and I mean, we're not at that stage yet, of course, because there's a lot of conflicting information out there. We don't have, very often, we don't have perfect resources to lean on, right? Hence the issue of fake news and all of that. So I don't think we're at a stage where we can say, well, I don't need to ask anybody anything or have any conversations because everything is out there for me to access, you know, in pure, simple form. But it's always worth thinking about all these great things that we can do, which means that I can look up things. I can make a PowerPoint for a presentation in like 15 minutes if I want to give a lecture that day. You know, the things we can do now is insane. For me, I'm always thinking about, okay, that's good. That makes me very efficient. But does it free me up to do more imaginative things? And I think that's not necessarily the case. I think we just tend to do more then. More work of a certain type. More, you know, we achieve more in a shorter time. I'm going to do 3 more classes. Like I could do 2 more podcasts today if I wanted, right? Whereas if we had to actually go to a studio, sit down, do that, that would be like take a couple of days. And but today, if I wanted, I could do 5 podcasts, right? So I think I might be using my time not to say, let me just do this one podcast. And I mean, I'm not doing any other podcasts today, don't worry. But it's more like the rest of my day, am I like freeing myself up to do something more on my terms? And I don't think we're doing that. I think we're just trying to do more, fit more and be more efficient, be more productive. So yeah, I don't think we're making use of our great efficiency in a way that, you know, gives us a little more of a relaxing time. I think if anything, it adds to our stressors in many ways.
So that concludes our first espresso of the Fueling Creativity podcast with Anna Abraham. In the next episode, we will be talking a little bit more about wonder and daydreaming and digging a little bit more into E. Paul Torrance, who certainly is an individual we've mentioned in past episodes of the show. My name is Dr. Matthew Irwood.
And my name is Dr. Cindy Burnett. This podcast was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with dadsforcreativity.com. Our editor is Sina Yousefzadeh.